Okay, so I'm very pleased to have Hamilton Souther here with me today on my podcast In a Perfect World. And Hamilton, you've been quite prominent as a Western representative in the shamanic world, in the ayahuasca scene for over a decade now, I guess. So could you maybe just introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background and how you've stumbled into this this shaman's path?
Yeah, well, my name's Hamilton, and I'm originally from California. Studied at the University of Colorado at Boulder, studied anthropology, and shamanism came to me. It wasn't something that I went to personally. I started having spontaneous visionary experiences that could only be described as shamanic the year after I graduated from college, and it sent me on a journey. Those visions sent me on a journey down into the Amazon, really to all of Peru, that ultimately ended in the Amazon. And I started working with traditional Amazonian practices and ayahuasca, and it became very clear in those initial ceremonies that I would train in that kind of shamanism, which for me at the time sounded fantastic, adventurous, and also beyond my capacities. I didn't think that it was something that I was going to be able to learn or establish a certain degree of mastery in. But apprenticeship is incredible in that fact that it's, you know, transforming. And so I went through a traditional apprenticeship, and which really consists of doing many dietas and participating in lots of ayahuasca ceremonies while you learn about the plants and the medicinal plants in the forest and establish a really deep bond and connection with the forest, which is a process in its own right because I wasn't from there and I had to learn how to live in the forest. And so all of that evolution turned into Blue Morpho, my shamanic ayahuasca center that I founded in 2002. And since then, we've been holding ayahuasca-related workshops and retreats and trying to present, you know, a very professional experience and also very authentic experience.
Okay, so let's backtrack a sec because, you know, this is... Well, it's a bit of a startling revelation to say, I mean, this is, you know, one of the traditional pathways, I guess, is there's a calling to the shaman's path. But you're, you know, just graduated college, 21-year-old, pretty average American from what I hear, in the sense of, did you have any inkling that this type of expanded worldview or, you know, like transgressing beyond the Western paradigm, did you have any leanings towards these sort of mystical states or these sort of cosmologies before your contact experience?
In some ways, but very informally, when I was in junior high, I started to have existential thoughts, and my beautiful child egoic world started to crumble, where it was just about, you know, going to school and liking it or not liking it, but not really questioning why. Once those questions started to seep in, I started to, you know, experience the battle of the mind and trying to use the mind to rationalize and reason experience. And the continuation of that led to these visionary states. I participated in some meditation and things like that before, but really, I didn't have a spiritual background at all. I didn't have a way to relate to it, or I hadn't found a kind of relevance in my life up until that point for it. And so really, it was kind of out of nowhere. It just appeared kind of from the deep depths of mysticism and all of a sudden was not only in my awareness, but it was in my mind and in my dreams and in my daily waking stated visions that I was having.
So, but basically it was a transmission, like it wasn't a random, you know, encounter. It was like something that was really dominatingly pulling you towards it.
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, I asked for it, and I don't have a way to be able to really explain why, other than that I'd come to a point where I was really kind of lost in the direction of my life. I think many of us connect with that idea that we're not really sure of our purpose, especially when we're in our youth and we're, you know, now about ready to launch into the world and into modern society and are looking for fulfillment, but also looking for a career. And so I didn't really have that direction, and things had gotten pretty dark for me over those years, and I was looking for a way out of that darkness. And so it was really my mom, which is, you know, interesting in its own right. She said to me, well, if you don't want to live your life like this anymore, why don't you give it back to spirit? And I thought to myself that that was the dumbest idea I had ever heard. And You know, I was deep in doubt and fear and judgment and criticism at that time. And so I thought, well, the only way to prove that there isn't anything going on is to actually do it. You know, so then I could prove it. I could say, all right, there's nothing here. Right? I did it. I gave my life back to spirit and nothing happened. Mm. Only I gave my life back to spirit and something happened. I started having visions.
Wow.
I started having visions, you know, the next day.
Mm. Well, this is the archetypal power of prayer, isn't it? The fact that the universe is not just open to our request, but it's symbiotic in a sense. We engage with it, and there's a relationship you can have with reality itself.
Yeah, what I learned in shamanism is that our experience and our shamanic experience is a bidirectional experience. One is an active process, which is rationalizing, thinking, seeing, going into. But another channel is the receptive channel. And the receptive channel is what allows for these mystical experiences to be experienced. Otherwise, the mysticism and the shamanism stays in the great unknown. We think about it, we talk about it, but we don't actually experience it. It's only in the communion and the receptivity to it does great universe or mysticism or, you know, the wholeness that's out there. I mean, there's so many different terms for it, but it responds.
Mm. Interesting. So look, tell me just a little bit more detail about your apprenticeship, because, you know, there's been other Westerners who are on the ayahuasca path now, but there's also, you know, these days, you know, over a decade since you first went down there, there's the lodge system and it's a bit more support networks. But originally when you went down there, you were pretty much on the, you know, the edge of the frontier, weren't you?
Yeah, there were other centers doing ayahuasca work, and I respected those centers, but it wasn't what I was personally looking for at that time. And I had spirits that were guiding me, and they were telling me where to go. And so without any criticism or judgment of the centers, I just went into the forest. But I didn't go into the forest specifically for ayahuasca. I went into the forest for the forest. I was looking and questing for my apprenticeship, but I didn't know in what kind of shamanism or what lineage of shamanism that I would end up ultimately being called to. It was still very unknown at that time. And so I went into the forest and connected with a shaman and participated in ayahuasca ceremonies. And in the visions of those initial ceremonies, I saw that I needed to stay in that very specific location for apprenticeship, which didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time because it was in a very isolated community of 8 families at the very end of a river, an upriver from us, a little river, I mean like a tiny little tributary to the Ucayali River, which is one of the main rivers that forms the Amazon. And so I was really on the edge of civilization. Upriver from me, there were no inhabitants for 6 days. It was just pure jungle. There were jaguar prints, you know, walking, that have walked through the night through our camp. There were animals everywhere, you know, the river teeming with fish. It was truly a sparsely populated area, and I was told I needed to stay there. So I worked with the local community to be able to stay and start to live with them. And then really after a year and a half, I was finally accepted by the master elder there, Julio Llerena Pinedo, to apprentice.
Mm.
And then formal apprenticeship started, which, like I said, consisted of diets and ayahuasca ceremonies, as well as excursions into the forest to learn about the different medicinal plants.
Right. Now, one of the things we've talked previously about is this idea, there's, you know, in the last decade or so of Western integration of ayahuasca or the ayahuasca experience coming through, there's been a romanticism around it, and there's been, you know, a cultural language developing around it. And ayahuasca herself, even in the pronoun there, or the her, has been really sort of solidified as an entity. And you've had a different experience, haven't you?
I have had a different experience. When I was in apprenticeship, I was really given a tremendous gift from the maestros that taught me. They brought me in to their families, and they treated me as if I were blood. And instead of presenting to me all of the common mythological stories, instead of teaching me verbally with those stories, they taught me entirely experientially. And they taught me telepathically through vision, which is a fantastic concept in its own right. But you're in ceremony, you're in a visionary state, and all of a sudden the master shaman's in there with you. And so it's very simple. It's instead of being in the room connected, you're in a visionary realm connected in exactly the same way, 3D vision, the ceremonial house, the ceremony could be at night, and all of a sudden you're floating in a canoe with the master shaman in daylight.
Mm.
You know, instantly transported, instantly teleported, and instantly also communicating telepathically. And so what I was presented with was an understanding that the plants are really made up of countless, uncountable numbers of spirits, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of spirits of all genders, male, female, as well as non-gendered beings, just light beings or energy beings or forms, and that the plant was using our own gender biases and our own gender considerations in the way that it presented itself. And so I learned about the plants in a non-gendered state, and over the years, the notion of ayahuasca being feminized came to kind of, I think, popular culture associated with it, and I was just surprised by that because it was different to what it was that I had learned.
Mm.
What I found was that the goddesses that are referred to in ayahuasca exist. They're there, and La Madre exists, but El Padre also exists, and there's royalty, there's kings and queens in these fanciful jungle worlds that also exist, and that it's not polarized to only one aspect of the plant.
Right. So, you know, within ayahuasca itself as an entity, though, you're saying that it has, like we do, it has the masculine, the feminine, the polarity. It's not just one or the other. Or are you saying that also ayahuasca is sort of the gatekeeper for that larger hierarchy of spirits that are out there as well?
I'm saying both. Mm. I'm saying that ayahuasca as a plant has a male, neuter, and female presence. It's a non-gendered being. The individual plants are gendered, but it's a non-gendered being in its own right, and it expresses itself through different gender nature in the way that it communicates with us, because human beings are incredibly gendered, and our culture is incredibly gendered, and there's been a lot of social evolution around that gender, and so for many people who are exploring and searching, gender is an important aspect and part of the discussion, and ayahuasca as consciousness knows that.
Mm.
And so it participates in that, and it communicates with us via the notion of the gender. And then ayahuasca is also a gateway to what I call the ayahuasca worlds. And those are spaces that are incredibly consistent and shared amongst a wide variety of participants. You know, like all the Shipibo art with the shapes, colors, and patterns. Almost everybody who participates in ceremony sees that.
Yeah.
And that those are indicative of worlds that are filled with beings that are inherent to ayahuasca and are only accessed through the practice of ayahuasca shamanism.
Mm. Wow. And so essentially then, you know, the ayahuasca as an entity or an avatar, it's reading and interpreting what our cultural data banks are individually and collectively and giving us the language. It's reading us for the language of how best to pattern match us, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look at what we're doing. Now, I've always said that there is not a person out in the world that knows what ayahuasca is beyond the plant.
Mm. And so,
once you go to the plant, you connect with the plant. You consume the plant and the plant mixtures, the different plants, and you bring them into your body, which is where the interaction starts to take place. And when you do that, people commonly say that they feel like the ayahuasca is going through the entirety of their body, like it descends to the points of their toes, goes all the way up through all the chakras, up out of the crown, energetically streaming through the whole body as well as the mind. It is performing a direct download of everything that you are on an energetic cosmic level. It's reacting to you as a single expression of consciousness, not the definitions of defined, structured, individual human being. It's saying you have those definitions within you, but you are this entire expression of consciousness, and it's merging with that consciousness, it's sharing that consciousness, and it's interacting with that consciousness. That's I've always said you can't hide when you're in an ayahuasca ceremony from the ayahuasca because you ingested it. You brought it into your physicality, which then goes through your mind and your imagination, your emotions, as well as your physical world.
So what do you think is happening on that healing level? Like there's a push at the moment, not just for ayahuasca, but for this medicalization of psychedelics and of these, you know, altered states. And that's there's a biochemical reaction happening. But what's happening on deeper levels then?
The biochemical reaction is directly connected to the deeper levels. We are biochemical beings, and we have the most fascinating chemical geometry and structures. Biochemistry is unbelievably complex and interesting, and we are coming into connection with also incredibly beautiful and structured beings in the forms of the plant world, and we are connecting with them. We're bringing them into us. There is an interaction that's taking place. And the healing that occurs is a shift in the chemical balances that are in us. There's a shift in the neurotransmitters that are present within the brain. There's a biochemical response that's happening physically. But there's also a mystical response. And the mystical response and mystical healing is taking place in spiritual realms that is related to changes or shifts in consciousness. And there's been a lot of talk about global shifts in consciousness and earth consciousness and human consciousness and shifts taking place within that consciousness. And what we're seeing in the revival of people turning to mystical plants and sacred plants for genuine personal spiritual experience and transformation is a merging of consciousness. And as that consciousness is merged with the intention of healing, which is very important, the intention is very, very important. When you have that intention for healing, you're saying to the plant, bring forth the aspects of your consciousness that create healing states. And so the mystical consciousness of the plant mixed with the mystical consciousness of the human being is merging and ascending, and it's creating an ascension in which place healing happens, it forms.
Yeah.
It manifests.
So, you know, within ayahuasca, there's also the potential for light and dark, and it's not just used for healing, is it? In the indigenous jungle set and setting, the use for brujeria or for negative intent is quite endemic in those cultures.
When I first went into the Amazon, that's what I started to experience. I started to have personal experiences of people that didn't want me there. And it was not common for the areas where I was living deep in the forest to have Westerners, gringos living there. And there was the use of those kinds of shamanic practices, those darker and dark shamanic practices, to try to affect me. And so I started learning in ayahuasca how to defend myself from them. And so I found them to be relatively prolific. Over the years, I came to understand two real main principles. Number one, human beings are dualistic in their nature. They're dualistic. Until they ascend out of the realms of consciousness of that dualism, they're bound to judgment and criticism. And that creates any number of negative expressions, conflicted expressions. And it was no different for people using ayahuasca down in the jungle. On the other side of it, what I saw is that the jungle didn't have an organized system of justice and retribution. They didn't have a system like a judicial system that functioned, that the people believed in and tried to use to solve problems. And so often they turned to the mystical for notions of payback or revenge.
Yeah. So, you know, this notion of brujeria or this cause and effect of one curandero waging war on either another or being paid by local people to put a spell on other people, it is quite pronounced all through South America, but it seems to have been sort of whitewashed as the Western romanticism around ayahuasca and the industry and the business of it seem to somehow paint it as a very different kettle of fish.
I was surprised around 2005, 2006 to see the discussion of it vanish. And I don't really know why it vanished, but the discussion of it all of a sudden was not part of the collective understanding. And only recently in the last couple of years have I seen it start to come back. And I think that that's happened based on people who've been exploring, who come into contact with these dark shamans, brujos, or, you know, dark mystical practitioners.
Mm. Yeah, there has been, you know, in recent years, quite a lot of fallout in the West's experiences with ayahuasca and some brujos.
You know, I think that really when we go back to ayahuasca, if we want ayahuasca to be about medicine, we have to become more sophisticated in what we're talking about. Mm. Ayahuasca is not just the plants itself. It's a ceremony and its intention, its direction. It's taught in lineages of shamans. It's a much more complex discussion than what typically takes place in the forums and stuff like that on ayahuasca. So there's a growing education that's taking place that requires an understanding of the culture where these indigenous practices are and where they were started, as well as an understanding of what kind of spiritual practitioners can help us fulfill our own intentions.
Mm. So as well as, you know, talking about lineage and this importance, and many Westerners are going down, they're finding a shaman, there's, you know, teething issues around this merging of cultures or sharing between cultures. But also, do you feel that there's a certain threshold that curanderos are willing to share their, basically, if this was a, you know, corporate language, it's proprietary information, or it's like this an intellectual, you know, property ownership. And so there's a certain level where ayahuasca is now popular and it's getting integrated into the West, but is there an upper limit to how much they will teach us their knowledge?
There's a number of different attitudes about that within the shamanic lineages and traditions, and the medicine men, the one that are truly medicinal practitioners, have the most open attitude about it.
Mm.
They're the most open, and then it goes all the way down to completely cut off, where Westerners are not allowed to participate. And so, yes, there is a capacity to be able to learn. My story is case in point that it is possible to be brought into those traditions and learn. But there is a certain amount of inherent naivete in Westerners thinking that they can go down into the Amazon and learn these arts in a very short period of time, like, you know, a month or 2 months, stay down there, do some dietas, participate, and feel like that they've gained the kind of shamanic mastery to safely wield these plants in ceremonial context.
Well, to be fair, though, like you had a very compressed apprenticeship as well. It was like 2 years sort of from, you know, training with your maestros to the time that you were given the title maestro yourself.
Correct. Compressed in the sense of a couple of years, also having already lived there, participating in the culture for the first year and a half, going through the extreme difficulty of being accepted into that culture. So from start to finish, when I was considered a maestro, from the time I first drank ayahuasca, not when I first started my formal apprenticeship with the master shamans, it was about 3.5 years. But even at a year and 10 months or 2 years, it's a lot longer period of time than a month or 2 months.
Mm. Okay. Well, look, tell us a bit about, you did, you know, graduate as a maestro shaman, you've got that lineage attached, and you formed the Blue Morpho Lodge. It's been an extremely popular lodge for many people going down to Peru, and you were, I guess, lucky in some senses. You had the National Geographic magazine in, I think it was March 2006, that had that story about you that really popularized the lodge and your work.
The article was fantastic for ayahuasca on a larger platform. It was one of the first major media sources around it. It also transformed the nature of our center. Our center started to cater to people that were coming for specific healing. Before that, people were coming to us mostly interested in the shamanic practices themselves. And so we saw a tremendous demographic change take place where all of a sudden people started to come to us who were less knowledgeable about the practices and actually wanting more from them. They were wanting to be able to duplicate the kind of experience that they were reading about. And so we experienced a surge in awareness and interest in our workshops, and then we worked really hard to be able to provide the same level of professionalism and quality of shamanism to the groups as they, you know, got a little larger.
Mm. So there has been that, yeah, it's such a recent thing, you know, in the last decade of ayahuasca industry, I guess, in Peru and as it moves out into the West. But this, you know, we're talking about the way the brujería was sort of swept under the carpet and this romanticism around Madre Ayahuasca, and it's sort of evolving into a, I guess, a spiritual brand or a modality which is uniquely got a Western flavor. And healing is very much, I think, part of that reason why it's spreading so rapidly and is so accepted. But as we're also discussing, you know, ayahuasca opens up deeper portals, doesn't it?
It opens up very, very deep portals. I would like to say that in general, I think that the evolution of shamanism globally is very, very positive. And I think that the shift in the focus to being more medicine-oriented and more healing-oriented is very, very important for the plants. The plants are most powerful and best used when there is that intention of healing, growth, and development, and learning from them as well. Expanding our consciousness, going to love, receiving from that love. And so I think it's very, very positive what has happened in that insurgent around healing. At the same time, there are certain concerns as the plants get spread and the culture starts to shift around it. And there are certain cultural safeguards that are found within the current practicing traditions that need to translate to the new practices, forms, and ways of use around the plants. And most importantly, they're around how to hold the space, set the space, the setting, the tone, the energy, and the direction that the ceremony flows in or how it takes place.
Well, speaking of proprietary knowledge, and if you don't feel comfortable asking this, you don't have to, but I'm interested in the understanding of what's really going on in ceremony and what ayahuasca is opening up and the role of the shaman or the curandero or the facilitator in driving the ceremony, you know?
I've always felt that the true mysticism around the shamanic practices is more powerful than any story that could ever be told about them. And so I've always been very open about sharing the information and the knowledge around how the shamanism gets practiced. I find it fascinating. And in ayahuasca shamanism, you have a triangle that's formed, a pyramid that's formed between the plant itself, the head medicine spirits of the plant, and the shaman. And the communication between those three pieces takes place through the ikaros that the shamans are chanting and singing in the ceremony. And the shaman has a tremendous amount of influence on the energies that are present in the ceremony. The shaman is acting as a gatekeeper for the ceremony, and it's really important because of that the shaman hold an intention that is in alignment with your intention in the ceremony. And so the shaman doesn't have control over the ceremony in the sense of being able to dictate each individual experience. It's not a willful control, but it's a guiding, directing influence on the ceremony. And so the shaman is in communication with the different kinds of plant spirits and animal spirits, nature spirits, celestial spirits that are being used in the ceremony for healing, for growth, for learning. They're communicating with you via the ikaros. The ikaros are vibrational communication. And when you're in ceremony, the vibrations are passing through you, and they're shaping and coloring the nature of the experience that you're having. And so the shaman is in a direct, very, very important role. It's the role of total responsibility for that ceremony to make sure that the ceremony flows and moves in the direction of the intention. And the intention always needs to be medicine and learning, healing and learning, healing and growth.
Mm. So there's an element there where I guess, in context, sort of what you're saying is the shaman themselves is basically moved by spirit, and spirit is working through the lens of the shaman to do not just do the healing, but the progression of the ceremony.
The progression of the ceremony is being orchestrated by the shaman and the spirits that the shaman works with. The shaman goes through apprenticeship to establish and develop the relationship to the spirits, to have the spirits transform them from apprentice to maestro, so that they are capable of being able to maintain that direct flow and movement with the spirits through the entirety of the ceremony. And they are giving voice, sound, direction, intention, and invocation to the ceremony.
Mm. You know, it brings up the question, many people say, well, why do either the plants or the spirits in the plants want to help the humans?
I think the question then becomes, not why do they want to help, but what are they?
Yeah.
And for me, spirits are structured energies. All things are structured energies. So I look at spirits as being tangible or intangible things. And what's interesting about structured energy in physicality is that it takes on a set of definitions. It takes on a set of parameters that it doesn't extend beyond. And I found that to be exactly the same with the spirits in medicine practices. What they do when they are put into motion in the ceremony is completely and fully express themselves. Mm. And so the nature of the healing medicine spirits, the structure that they have, practices and performs spiritual medicine. It's just what they do.
Mm.
It's why you can't ask an aspirin to be an Advil and an Advil to be an antibiotic.
Mm.
It's the exact same concept. The spirit is a structure, form of energy, and it expresses itself via consciousness. And people have repeated experiences across the entirety of the planet with these beings. They see the same beings, talk about the same beings, envision, experience the same beings, experience the same patterns of energy. And those patterns of energy have a nature. They have a nature of their own expression. And so they're put into motion in the ceremony, and it is their motion that is the practice of the medicine.
Mm.
And so the spirit expresses itself. It has a nature within it to heal. And not all plants have within them a nature to heal. There are specific plants that have within them that healing nature. Mm. And those are the ones that are considered shaman plants or medicine plants in the Amazon.
Mm. You know, it reminds me, someone was telling me the other day that, you know, within a human body, we actually have relationships with like thousands or tens of thousands of entities on a microscopic level. All the gut flora and all the little microorganisms all contribute collectively to making up the human organism, and we couldn't really function without them. And I wonder if it's like as above, so below, that on the astral ecology, there's all these, organisms which we are now interacting with through the nexus point of our physicality, and it's part of a larger, you know, larger Gaian organism.
You know, human beings are the epicenter.
Mm.
Human beings are the epicenter, period. The nexus, like you're talking about. We are biochemical, physical beings, as well as infinite spiritual beings.
Mm.
And it's simultaneously being expressed in every single moment of every single day. Part of that, which is also incredibly interesting to me, is that we have a locus of consciousness or awareness that in shamanism we call the focus or the focal point. And so what we experience between the physicality and the mind, the imagination, and the spiritual worlds is based entirely on where we're focused. So we change the direction or location of our focus, we turn it onto the spiritual worlds, and we experience the spiritual worlds. We keep it rooted in rational mind, and we experience rational thought. We get focused on the activity that we're doing, and we experience that activity that we're doing. And so a huge part of the shamanism is to get somebody to focus on something that isn't in the consistent habituated patterns. Get them to focus on something new, like medicine, or the medicine spirits inside the ayahuasca.
Mm. So do you think that, you know, you've got a whole wealth of wisdom here. Do you think that it's grown beyond what your maestros originally shared with you? Have you integrated the Western perspective or different facets of that?
The real beauty of the maestros that I worked with was that they didn't ask me to become them.
Mm.
They asked me to become what they would consider to be the maestro version of me. And so they transformed me, not into them, but into having the capacities to be able to hold the ceremonies and work with the medicine and the spirits. But I was always a Westerner. I was always a foreigner in their world. And so I feel very lucky that I was given the opportunity to live in their world, but I always was bringing in elements from outside the boundaries of their culture, which is also part of what allowed me to accelerate my growth and development through the apprenticeship. I started to hold ceremonies and ask the maestros to be in ceremonies with me because I never drank on my own until I was given the title of maestro, but I asked them to hold ceremonies with me more frequently than normal. I wanted to start participating in ceremonies with greater frequency. I wanted to add more plants to the diets, and I wanted to push those boundaries. And they were accepting of that. They were accepting of me doing that within their culture. But what was not accepted was an extension or a movement beyond the boundaries of medicine practice. So the entirety of the practice, the acceleration of the practice could take place, but it always had to be medicine practice, and it always had to be for healing and learning. And so in doing that, it's allowed me a natural extension into working with Westerners as well as relating to Westerners and bridging the gap between Western societal's understanding of shamanism and tribal society's understanding of shamanism. And it's given me a unique place that I'm also very grateful for to be able to help expand awareness on such incredibly healing and powerful practices. And I think that there's a very deep need inside modern society for modern citizens to have a way of connecting spiritually in a way that's satisfying and fulfilling to them. And shamanic practices offer that kind of fulfillment. They don't have to be plant-oriented. I've developed over the years a number of different kinds of shamanic disciplines, some of them that involve plant spirits and some of them that don't. Modern shamanism, which is a discipline I created, was there to support Westerners beyond their ayahuasca work when they came back and reintegrated into Western society to be able to continue the growth and development of the shamanism, but not using sacred plants. Using drumming, using trance work, focused meditation, self-hypnotic capacities, and the ability to continue to communicate with the spiritual world and the spiritual nature of themselves, to be able to receive guidance and knowledge beyond just what they experience in their normal everyday life. And then most recently, I've created the 420 shamanism movement and the 420 ceremony that works in the 420 ceremony in a cannabis-friendly environment to be able to, for people who are interested in participating, exercising their own state and or recreational rights, state medical rights or recreational rights to consume cannabis, a shamanic ceremony that is designed to raise consciousness in the direction of love to end conflict personally and on a global level.
Now, this is very exciting because this is exactly, you know, what we've just been describing, this evolution of the shamanic practice in the West. And, you know, to many people when they hear this phrase, cannabis shamanism, like it's quite stark because it does marry, you know, cannabis and shamanism, and shamanism has been on the rise in the West, but cannabis has been, you know, demonized for generations now, but it's also been redeeming itself. It's been proving itself as a, you know, the medical marijuana movement. It seems to be that we're turning the corner in 2014 on a few fronts with the legalization in two states of America of recreational marijuana use, the medical marijuana movement all through the world, in fact. But do you think Westerners get the fact that cannabis is a sacrament?
I think what we've experienced is collectively a loss of the traditional practices. And cannabis has a more than 5,000-year history being used in direct relationship to mysticism. But the problem with mystical traditions is that it's the man in the cave. Or the woman in the forest by herself. They're not traditions that are generally shared on a much larger platform. The plants have extended, and the use of them is on a much larger platform. And as the plants were made illegal, it created an illegal trade around that platform. And the sharing of the mystical nature of the plant is lost. And so what I'm bringing forth is an understanding that shamanism can be used in conjunction with cannabis to bring forth an acceleration and a deepening of the shamanistic practices, and that they can support the medical use of cannabis, and they can bring a very respectable, very responsible use of cannabis to people that are recreationally using it. That this could be something very, very beneficial to people, to show them that there is consciousness found within the plant that has an ability to help them. And that we can set this intention to love, and we can ask the plant to guide us to love, and the plant has an ability to help open us to this mystical love that's all around us, that's in us and through us, that really does bring peace. And so we have a way to connect shamanistically with the plant itself, bringing forth the personal spiritual experience. And then we have a way of guiding and directing it to love, which promotes an ascension of consciousness. And as consciousness rises individually and collectively, what we see are people that love more. They have more love in them. They have a greater expression of love in everything that they do, and that love is positively transformational. That love is supportive of society, and it's supportive of community.
Well, let's unpack that a bit, because I mean, I think it's so interesting, because something like ayahuasca coming from the jungle and having the lineage and the indigenousness to it, in some ways, even though it's very out there and it's hallucinogenic and it's stretching the paradigm of the West, it might almost be more acceptable because it's coming from a different vector. You know, it's coming into our culture from outside in a way. But cannabis has been part of Western culture for generations now. And, you know, when some people hear cannabis shamanism, there's still going to be some type of resistance, I think, because people have a habitual relationship with using it in a certain way. So what you're saying is it is a sacrament, it is a plant that has presumably a spirit in it as well. And beyond even that, it's using that sacrament as the catalyst for the ceremony. So you're actually transposing these what you've learned from ayahuasca shamanism and the container that you hold in ceremonial practice and the structure that you bring to that. And that creates a ritual, that creates intent, and it creates a container for that experience to unfold in.
Yes, I created Blue Morpho Cannabis Shamanism, and Blue Morpho Cannabis Shamanism is a discipline in its own right, and the discipline is a mixture of different shamanic disciplines that I've trained and worked in. And so the first is traditional Amazonian shamanism, the second is modern shamanism, and the third is universal mysticism. And there is a ceremony associated to the nature of the practice, very much like other kinds of traditional ceremonies, where there's chanting, there's use of percussive instruments to be able to help guide with sound, there's ikaros, there's the invocation of the spirits with the collective intention. Everything that makes up a traditional, formal, sacred plant medicine ceremony is part of the 420 ceremony. The resistance, or lack thereof of resistance, I think is twofold. There are people who only can relate to the idea of cannabis in one way, and then there are other people who are open-minded and have already had spiritual experiences associated with it. The idea of bringing shamanism to it is to give a guided direction to the spiritual experience, and to also increase the potency of that spiritual experience. Mm. To set a time and a place where this ceremony can happen and people are awakened and ready to have a personal spiritual experience or communion. And so I think that in one sense, people would only relate to cannabis in a way that is within the framing or preconceived framing that they already have. But you also have a situation where cannabis to people who've already experienced it is non-threatening.
Mm.
It's a plant that isn't as scary as ayahuasca.
Mm.
And so there's a possibility, a great possibility, for people to be drawn to the idea of being able to have spirituality and direct spiritual communion be part of their already existing cannabis use.
Yeah. Well, it changes the dynamics. It explodes the sort of playing field in so many ways because it, you know, ayahuasca's also got these drawbacks, and then it takes a certain amount of years for it to grow to fruition. There's the supply and the demand of the plant, the over-harvesting issues. But cannabis, you know, is grown all over the world. There's different strains. There's presumably different sort of maybe spiritual flavors or connection to different devas within that plant. And as you say, it's already it's accepted in the West to a degree. It's even if it's the underground, people have a relationship already with marijuana. So if you can bundle the shamanic ritual to a marijuana ritual, it could be quite diverse and quite deep the take up of this practice.
Yeah, absolutely. We've already done that. I've already created the nature of the ceremony, and I'm already hosting the 420 ceremony. Our inaugural ceremony is going to be on April 20th this year, and I'm going to live stream the ceremony through a password protected channel for free. And so anybody interested in participating in this kind of a ceremony will be able to participate in the 420 ceremony. And the intention of the ceremony is to raise consciousness through a focus of love to end conflict, personal and global. And so this is something that people will be able to experience entirely for free. It's a way that I'm open in sharing the shamanistic medicines, the intention of love, the tremendous mystical powers and transformational powers of love to be able to positively affect individuals and also a larger expression hopefully ultimately a global expression.
So just give us a bit more context so people can understand, because it's a big sort of leap of faith, if not ideology here. It's basically the same container as an ayahuasca ceremony. It's done in the dark. There's a group of participants. They take the sacrament. You run the ceremony and drive the ceremony with Ikaros, with the vibrational healing songs.
So far, so good.
Yeah. Okay. And then people are in an altered state. People have agreed on what their intent is. And then it's working for, it's still a healing modality.
It's absolutely a healing modality. It's a positively transformational modality, which I consider all healing modalities to be. There's the potential in it for people to be positively affected. If they give their intention to love, to have transformation take place in their life, love has the capacity to be able to bring forth all different kinds of transformation, including healing. Not only that, we're working with a medicinal plant. The plant has been already identified as a medicinal and healing plant. And so we're using the focus of love and the intention as well as the shamanism to support its medical use.
Mm. And so what happens on this more esoteric sort of astral level, though? You're saying that there's a diva or a spirit in marijuana herself, and then through that conduit, it opens up, you know, you're working with other spirits outside the marijuana spirit as well?
Absolutely. There's just like in the Amazonian tradition, the plants are filled with many, many different kinds of spirits. And the desire and the goal in the shamanism is to guide and direct the focus of our awareness and attention into communion with specific spirits found within the plant. And so in the ceremony, the spirits that are being used are called medicine spirits. They are the spirits that bring positive transformation. And we call to the head medicine spirit, or the ultimate expression of that positive transformation. We connect with that spirit. It comes into communion with us. We experience its presence through our own perception. It starts to change the nature and the shape of what the cannabis experience is, what somebody normally experiences. It starts to take on a deeper energetic and more spiritual connotation, and a communion and for some communication will form with that spirit. We are guiding the spirit to guide us collectively into the ascension of consciousness and the connection to mystical love. And mystical love is defined as in and through all everything, all the time, streaming through you, through the entire space, through the air, through every thought. But the mystical conundrum is, why aren't people experiencing it as love? And so the shamanism gives us a mechanism to be able to connect with love in a direct way. And the help of the cannabis spirits and medicine spirits beyond just the cannabis plant that we can call to in our invocation are there to be able to support this interconnectivity with love. And what we experience is an ascension in consciousness, and the response is that for days and days beyond, people have less stress, they feel better, it's incredibly, incredibly positive for them, relationships start healing, positive transformation takes place.
Mm. So what I say, so this focus on, you know, on love itself, it's very different from the Peruvian working with the plants. They're not necessarily focused on love per se.
No, they're not. There are beings within the plants that are focused on love and support that intention. And so in ayahuasca, you have to find them. You find them by focusing on them, by invoking them and calling them, and then you meet them. I've always been more of a mystical philosopher than I have been shaman, but I was trained in the shamanism, and I have tremendous gratitude for being trained in it because it allowed me to give motion and direction to the mysticism. Mm. And the ultimate expression of the mysticism is this oneness or this wholeness or this love that I'm talking about. And so this is where the tradition and the Blue Morpho Cannabis Shamanism and the 420 ceremony gains the focus and the intention of love. It's born in universal mysticism.
Mm. And in your ceremonial practice, you know, you sing some of the Icaros in the native language, whether that's Quechua or the Spanish, but you also translate to the English, and you also sort of a teaching. They're sort of like you're teaching through your songs for Western people, aren't you?
Yes, the Icaros are systems of communication, some of which that is intellectual. And when Westerners go down into the Amazon and they listen to traditional shamans singing traditional Icaros, they're not always aware of the fact that the words that the shamans are singing are directly relating and painting the universal picture and the ceremonial picture of the visionary experience. And so over the years, I've translated, I phonetically created the language of the Icaros, and then I had the shamans that I was working with translate them for me, and I was able to form an English equivalent to them and be able to express verbally what it is that the shamans are doing with the Icaros. And so what it does is it awakens the Icaro even more for somebody, because the Icaro is the sound, it's the rhythms, it's the combination of the singing or chanting with the instruments that are being played. It's the focused intention of the shaman, as well as the lyrics or the verbiage that's being used in the Icaros. And it's the language aspect of it that's most lost on people who just don't speak the language. And so I've wanted to translate that for people so they could have a greater understanding of what it is that we're focusing on. For instance, if we're in a ceremony together and I start singing an Icaro for butterfly medicine, for the medicine of butterflies to come into the room, and all of a sudden the energy gets to be very light for people and it gets very fluttery, which is what butterfly medicine will do if I bring it into the room,
mm-hmm.
It's also nice to have them know that what I'm calling is butterfly medicine. Then they know in their mind and in their imagination and in their receptivity to become receptive to butterfly medicine. And then without having to describe what that is, everybody now has a capacity to open that receptive channel to butterfly medicine and have a personal experience of it.
Mm.
And the learning shamanistically happens through personal experience. And so by using the Icaros in the 420 ceremony, we're able to bring the traditions, the traditional shamanism, as well as modern practices. I'm also able to translate them to be able to bring greater guidance and collective movement. And this is really important since we're live streaming the ceremony. Since the ceremony is going to be held in a private residence and people are going to experience it via the hybridization of technology and shamanism, they're going to live stream it through their computers or through their internet-connected TVs. And so having very direct guidance, what it is that we're collectively focusing on is what brings this massive collective conscious experience. We have this collective consciousness that we're tapping into in a massive way. And so we know at that time, well, let's connect with the head medicine spirit. Let's connect with love. Let's remember the heart. And so I can, you know, use guidance in the translation of the Ikaros to be able to bring more understanding to the shamanistic practices.
Mm. So, you know, it is quite an amazing advancement, I feel, that you're doing here, because not only, you know, a different sacrament with cannabis and all the socio-political ramifications around that, and then the different logistics in ceremony, but it's sort of opening up to the practice of ritual itself, not just the sacrament, but this idea of streaming it to the internet and to other people. So is the best sort of possible outcome that people are also, in this instance, on cannabis and on the same sort of morphic resonant frequency, so they can then receive the teachings? Do they have to be on the same sacrament?
No, the ceremonies have the intention of love so that we can transcend the need for the use of medicinal plants. The medicinal plant becomes entirely supportive of the ceremony instead of being necessary for the ceremony. The ceremony is all about raising consciousness, of which there are many, many different ways to do it, shamanism being one of them. Shamanism is what I trained in, and so I like to use shamanism, and I love shamanism. I love the practices, I love the chants, I love the ceremonies, I love the instruments and the percussion, I love the energies that are involved in it. The medicines just feel so good. It feels so good to have a holistic experience of mind, imagination, body, and emotion. It's good to feel the movement of the energies and to release stagnation. But it's not necessary. Westerners are so mentally oriented, and they're so rationally oriented, and they're so actively oriented, that to get them into a receptive state is sometimes more difficult.
Mm.
To be able to induce the trance that is needed for the shamanistic journey or experience really just requires that first shift in consciousness. And so sacred plant medicine has a psychoactive component that accentuates or helps that process. And so in this case, these ceremonies are entirely cannabis friendly. It's just a question of, it's optional. It's whether or not you have a relationship to that plant and you want to bring that relationship to this ceremony. But the collective intention is love to transcend conflict. Mm. And we're using the cannabis to support that.
You know, I guess the term digital shaman has been bandied about in some ways with musicians and electronic musicians and that culture, you know, helping facilitate altered consciousness of people dancing to that music. But in this sense, it's almost like you've got distributed shamanism. So you're there centralized in ceremony, broadcasting a carrier wave of your intent and the healing energy over your carrier wave. And if people are receptive all around the world, like, this could work with or without sacraments, but even it could revolutionize the way the West practices shamanism, because ayahuasca ceremonies could have that centralized facilitator shaman broadcasting, and there could be, instead of just listening to, you know, songs on their iTunes or something while they're in ceremony without a practicing, you know, facilitator, if that facilitator's energy could really permeate through and connect with people in ceremony across the world in one go, it just sort of changes the whole ball game, doesn't it?
Yes, the idea of sharing the shamanism is a movement from the focus of shamanism being associated to lineage and tribal society to a much more expansive modern society. The resurgence of shamanism is not taking place in the traditional worlds. Those traditions are long-standing and strong within themselves. And the growth and the spreading of shamanism is taking place in the West. And one of the key aspects of a Westerner is that they have access in this incredible technology information age to an unbelievable amount of information. And so merging of technology and information to the shamanism makes total sense to be able to share it on a much larger platform. One of the current problems that we have is legality around the use of shamanistic plants. And so for me, I highly recommend participating with the plants in a place where there's legality associated with it.
Mm. But then,
in countries where it's legal.
But then, of course, if that's not possible, you know, this streaming shamanism could be an option as well.
It ends up being an option, but then you have the question of the energy around the ceremonies themselves and the nature of the legality. If you start pushing the legal boundaries associated with the use of the plants, you're going to experience a certain kind of legal backlash with it. And we haven't seen that in people who are you know, sharing ayahuasca around the world, which is something that I've never done. I mean, I created a destination-based center in Peru, and I only practiced with ayahuasca in Peru, but, you know, there's a movement of people that are utilizing ayahuasca in other parts of the world, and my concern is if you share it on a much larger platform where people are drinking ayahuasca on their own and are connected in that way, that you might see a kind of much larger backlash that could take place.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is by doing a digital ceremony and transmitting the healing energy, it's sidestepping the plants.
In the digital aspect of it, if they wanted to participate in the ceremonial aspect with a shaman holding an ayahuasca ceremony in a place that's legal and streaming it, the transference of energy could be incredible.
Because it's essentially the Icaros of vibrational medicine, and vibration can travel now across the internet, so theoretically, time and space aren't the issue anymore.
Well, if the shaman has the ability to be able to hold everybody together, that's very, very true.
Yeah, right.
That's very, very true. There's one aspect in the shamanism that has to be taken into consideration, which is the shaman's ability to hold the collective experience in a collective.
Mm.
And so shamans get very comfortable with, you know, certain kinds of sizes. But if shamans had the capacity to be able to hold that, it would absolutely be possible. It would be possible for people to experience all different kinds of shamanistic practices through the use of technology and the merging of technology.
Yeah. So, you know, I was talking about this idea of, you know, cannabis shamanism at one of our film screenings, one of the panel discussions that came up, and some people had a bit of resistance to this idea. It almost, they were feeling like with the marijuana movement in the States here, it might have been perhaps cashing in on that movement and grafting, you know, the shamanistic modality to that movement here where it's becoming legal. But could you just tell us a bit about the origin of how you came across this idea and how this has been sort of spiritually transmitted?
Yeah, I want to address first the question around, you know, the idea of the movement itself and the movement of, you know, media attention to cannabis and stuff like that. And the whole purpose of the 420 ceremony is to offer it for free.
Mm.
The whole purpose is to stream it on the 20th of every month for free so that we can share shamanism collectively on a much larger platform. And so the idea is share the intention of love, right? And do it in a way that's for free.
Hmm. Well, that takes all the capitalist sort of angle out of it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's not part of it. This is about love, and this is about experiencing shamanism and shamanism being a conduit to a direct experience of that love. And it's not specifically about cannabis, but like I said, it's connected to Blue Morpho Cannabis Shamanism as being a friendly environment to that and supportive, because these are the kinds of spirits that we're going to be working with in that ceremony to achieve that attention to love. And then the idea of it being for free is to share with people how shamanism can positively affect us and how love transforms. Now, all of this got started really because of the fact that the movement already exists. It got started because I was living in the United States, sharing the other shamanic disciplines that I created that were not plant-oriented. And I was here promoting the creation of shamanism-infused music through a project that I have called Source Independent Entertainment, where I infuse shamanism into the music that we create to generate the same states of consciousness that promote the experience and the ascension to love.
Mm.
And I was experiencing significant chronic pain, extreme chronic pain, in my hip and in my lower back, associated to a hip dislocation and hip fracture that I experienced in 2010, 2011. And so I had used medicinal plants in the Amazon to treat the chronic pain, and when I came to the States, I was no longer able to access those medicinal plants, and I started to experience the chronic pain up until the point that somebody said, well, have you tried medical cannabis? And so I went and I got my card, and I went and tried it, And I tried it not for a mystical shamanic purpose. I tried it to treat chronic pain. And what happened was this incredible explosion and fusion of all the shamanism and mysticism that was already inside of me as soon as I went into the cannabis space.
Mm.
And I wasn't expecting it. It was mind-blowing. It was incredible. It was fantastic and again, life-changing. And so when I talked before about the plant doing this kind of download on you, I went in and the plant saw all of these different disciplines of shamanism and mysticism that I practiced and was just excited. It just wanted to shamanize. It wanted to express the shamanism. It wanted to hear Ikaros. It asked me to sing Ikaros. I sang Ikaros. It loved the Ikaros. And from that, I started to develop this discipline of shamanism where I quickly realized that this could be used in a ceremonial setting, so the ceremonial setting was created. How to be able to communicate with the plants was drawn from Amazonian shamanism. The mysticism and the philosophy expressed through modern shamanism and universal mysticism. And it quickly took shape and form. And so I have incredible gratitude to the states being able to have laws for medical cannabis because it started to treat my chronic pain, which has helped tremendously. And I found that the ceremonial use of cannabis has intensified dramatically the kind of help and support I get from the plant medicinally. So if I were just using it to treat chronic pain, I would have to use it a lot more. But in conjunction with the ceremony, I found I have a much longer lasting positive effect on the chronic pain than I would have otherwise. So I can do a ceremony, treat the chronic pain, and then the chronic pain doesn't come back for 3, 4, 5 days instead of needing to use it every day to treat the chronic pain. And so it's allowed me an even more respectful use and a more focused use using the shamanism to support its medical reason.
Mm. And do you think that this, you know, this modality, now that you've sort of birthed into the world, it's almost like an obvious marriage of, shamanistic ceremony and predominantly the predominant Western sacrament, marijuana, you know? And so it could really take off on a grassroots level as well.
Well, what I hope for is that people are interested in experiencing it. Shamanism, like I said, is all about the experience itself. And so when we're considering about having an experience, it can bring up certain questions, certain fears and concerns, which is why we have a focus of love. And I think we can all agree that a focus and an intention on love is ultimately beneficial for everybody. And we have a friendly environment that isn't sacrament necessary. We have a ceremony where it's open to people that are interested in participating as well as not. It's open to anybody who wants to be in the ceremony and experience an intention of love for a personal reason as well as a global reason.
Mm. Wow. Well, it's exciting times that are upon us, Hamilton. And so what's the main website, or how can people connect with this?
People can sign up through 420ceremony.org. And you just put in your email. You need to be 21 years or older to be able to receive the stream, and the stream will be password protected. And weeks before the event, we will start, which is on April 20th, we will start sending out information more about the event, how to prepare for it, how to be in the right receptive state for it. And you can also go to HamiltonSouther.org. And there's information on all of my projects, including extensive information on 420 ceremony.
Fantastic. Wow. Okay. It's been a huge download. Thank you so much for your time, Hamilton. It's really amazing the work that you're doing in the world and where you've come from and, you know, the last decade or more of work. And it feels very, very exciting where you're going with all this too.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really appreciative to everybody that has supported me over the years, and I look forward to sharing this for as long as I possibly can. I would like to share shamanism with people on a wider platform and be able to have more people experience how it's positively transformational. And I think that that's really the key and the reason for the rise in interest and awareness around shamanism in the first place.
Yeah, excellent. All right, Hamilton, keep up the good work. Many blessings to you.
Same back to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Aloha.